Well, thank you for coming out this evening. Beautiful evening like this, and I hope we'll have a beautiful evening shared together. I had a wonderful afternoon with Doug and his wife and his family. I fell in love with your mountains here. I'm from Ohio. And please don't ever, ever take your mountains for granted. I know when you live close to something like this, you have a tendency, you know, well, I see them every day, you know. Oh, treasure them. They're a masterpiece of creation. You are so, so fortunate to live here. I'm also happy that you came out and you're interested in learning about another type of transcendent experience, the near-death-like experience, which I had. I asked PMH Atwater recently, I said, who coined that term, near-death-like experience? And she said, go figure, wasn't me. So she said, I have no idea. And yet the term is incorporated now into NDE literature. So if any of you here know who may have coined that term, I don't know either, so. But we use it. I get a little disturbed about all these different terms that people are inventing to describe something, because really, in essence, what we're talking about are mystical experiences, a large family of mystical experiences. Near-death experiences, near-death-like experiences are only part of mystical experiences. I'm going to be sharing my near-death experience and my near-death-like experience with you, but before I do, I'd like to preface it a little bit by telling you how difficult it is for near-death-like experiencers. There's basically little or no information within the general public community about this type of experience. Remember when NDEers first came out talking about their experience before Ray Moody's book came out, Life After Life, and before the media got on the bandwagon and started interviewing experiencers and researchers? How many of you had that kind of experience before then? Then you know what I'm talking about. You probably were reluctant to share your experience with family or friends because you thought that they would consider you crazy. So you either didn't talk about probably the most beautiful, life-transforming experience of your life, and inside you wanted to share. It's like winning the lottery or something. You want to tell people that there is life after death, but no one wanted to listen back then. But until the public got more information through the media, through books, through interviews, through ions being formed, it was very, very, very difficult. Well, near-death-like experiencers are facing that same problem, because we are the early pioneers, just as NDEers were the early pioneers back in those days. And so we face rejection. We face people scratching their heads. How can you say you have the identical experience as someone who was close to death? You weren't close to death at the time. I don't understand that. And so when we don't understand something, it's easy to shoot from the hip and then judge the person to be either fanatical or wacky or whatever. That's our natural inclination. But you know what, folks? These transcendent experiences transform people's lives. They need to be shared. They need to be given to others who have no clue what is going on. Why? Well, it might happen to you one day, and you'll be a little better informed. Or you might know someone who had the experience and be able to be a gentle friend, compassionate to that person, allowing them to share their experience with respect and dignity. And you might learn something in the process. So I'm very glad that you're open to coming this evening and allowing me to talk about this. Another thing that I get a little itchy about is that when we're talking about near-death experiences, we are so interested and fascinated by the events leading up to the actual moment of that transcendent experience, i.e. the drowning, the shooting, the stabbing, the heart attack, and etc., etc. And those are very dramatic events that precede the experience. But when we're talking about the transcendent experience, we are talking about at that moment in which consciousness transcends the physical body, transcends the physical dimension, and enters into another otherworldly reality or other dimension. That's the experience, and that's what we're really interested in learning more about, aren't we? Those of you who want to know what it's like after death. Yeah, you're interested in someone talking about, you know, how they nearly arrived at death's door, but that isn't the experience. So the trigger mechanism isn't that important. Interesting, but not that important. It doesn't matter how you got there. It just matters that you got there. Let me try to put it to you another way. Basically, all of us right now are having a shared, similar experience. You're all in this room. You're all listening to me speak. Some of you may notice the clothes I'm wearing. Some of you may notice some of the things around the room. Some of you may hear someone coughing in the back row. Someone else may never have heard that before. So there will be different things that you will see and hear while in this shared experience. Maybe you drove your car to get here by yourself. Maybe you came with someone. I'm laughing, excuse me. Maybe you came with Doug tonight and sat in the back seat. And poor Lisa, slow down, you know. And so it might be interesting for me to share what that experience was like, you know, the fear or the anxiety or the laughter or whatever. But that doesn't have any impact on this shared experience right here. Do you see what I'm trying to help you to understand? This experience that matters. Now, when you leave tonight, some of you may have different interpretations of this shared experience tonight. Some of you may go away saying, boy, she is wacky. Never heard of anything like that. Put her in the loony bin. Someone else may be deeply inspired by what I have to say. Others may think, well, that was an entertaining evening and that was all that I got out of it. So you see, the experience here will have many different interpretations once the experience here ends. And so it is with near-death experiences and as well as near-death-like experiences. In 1992, IAMS conducted a poll within their membership, and 229 people responded. Some of you are familiar with this, but for those of you who don't know, 20% answered the question, how did you come to your experience? 20% said they came to it during clinical death. 40% said they came to the experience suffering serious illness or physical trauma of some sort. And get this, 37% said they came to the experience without coming close to death, without suffering serious illness or physical trauma of any sort. Now, National IAMS has been following this pretty carefully through the years, and it's still neck and neck. They recently came out and said, you know, we may have more near-death-like experiencers than NDEers. Something is going on here. We need to explore. We need to take a closer look at this. William James once said, in order to prove that all crows are not black, it is necessary to find only one white crow. Well, guess what? I'm that white crow. We've had 30-plus years of scientific research into one trigger mechanism, the near-death experience. We have spent lots of intellectual understanding of what makes an NDE or tick, what are the after effects, what is this. But nothing about your death-like experiences. Nothing about those white crows that are knocking at researchers' doors and saying, let me in, take a closer look at me. You know what? I bet you're going to find that white crows fly the same way as black crows. Bet you're going to find out they nest the same way, they eat the same foods. The only difference is the color. The only difference between NDEs and near-death-like experience are the trigger mechanisms. That's all. I decided to take a closer look at this and conduct a research study myself into the area of near-death-like experiences. So if there's anyone here who has had anything similar to a near-death experience, please contact me. Please let me know, because we've got to get this information out to the general public. All right, I'm going to talk about my first near-death experience. During childbirth in 1962, I had toxemia of pregnancy, characterized by severe edema, extreme high blood pressure, which led to convulsions, and eventually my death. At the moment of death, I, my spirit self, or whatever you want to call it, lifted out of the physical body, and about ceiling level, I was looking down at the medical team frantically working on Nancy down there. Well, I was looking at Nancy down there as if I was looking at an old coat that I didn't need anymore, or a covering that I didn't need anymore. Total detachment. I didn't need that body anymore because I was very much alive, although in a different form, up here, looking down at that lifeless form below. I was in a very, very, very peaceful, almost blissful state. I loved being there. I was in a dark void. However, the darkness did not bring me any fear at all. I was very happy to be there. I saw the light, and I was drawn toward the light. However, the nurse below was pounding on Nancy's chest, saying, come on back, Nancy, come on back, come on back. I don't want to come back, you know. I'm fine where I am. I'm so happy where I am. There's no pain. I don't want to come back. So I kind of disregard that, and I'm going toward the light. Nancy, come on back, come on back. You have a son. And this sounds horrible to say, but it's the truth. I felt nothing for my son who was born. I mean, there was total detachment to anything of this earth plane. I love my son. He's a wonderful son. You know, I'd give my life in a second for him. But at that moment, I'm trying to convey to you sincere feeling of bliss, of perfectness, while out of the body and seeing the light. I felt like a rubber band being pulled toward the light, a rubber band being pulled back down here with that nurse's incessant nagging. Oh, gosh, she was a pest. Really? Don't want to come back. Why are you bugging me, you know? Don't understand this. Let me go alone. And then I finally remember thinking in my mind, well, I guess the only way to stop her incessant nagging is to just do what she told me to do. So, wish I could tell you I came back for some good, higher spiritual purpose or something like that, but it's just simply to stop incessant nagging and from preventing me from continuing on in my journey that I so wanted to move forward with. So, I came back and went into my body. Now, the next thing I remember is tactile sensations. I felt that I was lying on a very cold metal surface. I felt something covering me. So I took my fingertips and I touched, oh, it's a sheet. So I pulled it down over my face to my neck, and I'm staring up on this cold metal table, and I'm looking at the lights, and I could hear motion to my left, but I turned to my right, and I saw another metal gurney with a body lying on it with a sheet covering it. I turned this way again, and I blacked out. The next conscious awareness I had was waking up in my hospital room, thinking, what happened? You know, was that the morgue I recovered in? Boy, when my doctor comes, am I going to have a few words to say to him? And he came, and he said, how are you? I said, oh, I'm fine, but I have some questions. I said, what happened? What went wrong? He said, nothing went wrong. What? Well, come on, I'm not going to tell him. Well, I lifted out of my body and I could see you down there, you know, and the nurse is pounding on my chest. He would have sent me straight to the psych ward, you know. In 1962, you didn't hear about this, okay? There was no way I was going to tell him I saw everything. No way. I kept insisting. No, tell me. I know something went wrong. What happened? No, nothing. You had a normal delivery. I said, no, I don't think so. Please tell me. I think it's my right to know. With that, he came over, put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, look, I'm an excellent physician. I'm afraid that if I told you what happened, it would cause so much psychological distress that you would never, ever want to have children again. You want to have children again, don't you? After 39 hours of grueling labor and what I went through, I said, yes, of course. Yeah, sure. So he said, all right then. From this moment on, move forward with your life. Don't look back. Just forget about all this. I'm telling you for your own good. Just move on. So he wasn't going to tell me anymore. And believe it or not, that's what I did. I never told anyone what happened. Not until my second experience in 1979, and I started learning more about near-death experiences from interviews and Moody's book and so forth and so on, to know that, you know, uh-oh, I had one of those, you know, during childbirth. I had my medical records forwarded to me, and we went through them, and there is no record that anything happened. The records state that I had a normal delivery. But I ask you, I have subjective proof. I know what happened. I was there. Okay? But I ask you, is that something a doctor would tell a patient who had a normal delivery? Okay. Just so we're on the same page. That's what it was like in the 60s. So it really wasn't a very, very deep experience at that time, but I think that experience opened me up somehow. Because after that, I became more psychic. Well, I had always sort of had paranormal experiences throughout my life and mystical experiences when I was a child around 4 years old. I think that it prepared me in some way for my big experience in 1979, somehow. The events leading up to that 79 experience are pretty detailed, and I'm not going to go into some of them because of the time constraints here, but I write all about it in my book, and I think some of you may be shocked to learn what happened to me, and like I said, it's so involved, I don't want to get into it now, but trust me, I grew up not ever having had any religious formal instruction, although I am Catholic. I'm Ukrainian Catholic, and I was raised in a Ukrainian family in a Ukrainian coal mining town. The church was composed of all Ukrainian members and a Ukrainian priest, so when I went there as a young girl and on up, I had no idea what the priest was talking about. Talking Greek or a foreign language to me. I didn't understand the language. So I never heard stories about, you know, that are recorded in the Bible. I don't know anything. I don't know anything. I'm very ignorant. I'll put it right out on the table for you. I just want you to keep that in mind. Tuck it somewhere in the back of your mind because I'll be talking about something else in a little bit. For the most part, I was your average woman. I was not interested in psychic phenomena, reading books of spirituality. I wasn't into philosophical thinking about meaning of life issues and so forth. I was just your next door neighbor. I was a wife, a mother, a career person, a community leader, and the books that I read were family-oriented, recipes, gardening books, something that would help me be a good mother, a good family woman. However, I was trained in the scientific method, and so I naturally have a very analytical and skeptical mind. For me, I have to weigh everything before I really take it to heart, you know, because that's that scientific, analytical mind. However, in 1979, a very dear friend of ours, I'll call him John, died while piloting his small airplane from Alaska to our hometown in Ohio. The night of his crash, I had a precognitive dream. Precognitive, of course, meaning future events that do come true. I get a lot of those kind of dreams. And when I wake up in the morning, I have a feeling inside the pit of my stomach. It's as if I know that's happening, or I know it's going to happen. Unlike, oh, that was just a dream, you know, I just pass it off. In my dream, I saw John piloting his airplane, and I was looking at him through the side window. He was so happy flying his airplane. He loved it over the rugged Alaska mountains and glaciers below. And all of a sudden, his face took on a tortured, panicky expression. And the instrument panel was beginning to form ice on. And he was futilely trying to gain control of the plane and could not. Realizing the futility, he turned his head away from the aircraft, looked right at me through the side window and called out my name, Nancy, and then the plane crashed. So I said when I woke up, oh no, this can't happen. I mean, John is like a brother to me and to my husband, and their children are sons. Like, I mean, we're very, very, very close. Can't happen. No. That was just a dream. An hour after I woke up, his wife called and she said, John's plane crashed in Alaska and he was killed. So, the next day, a few days, naturally were grief-filled days for us. His wife asked me to deliver the eulogy at his funeral service, and I said, no, I can't do that. I can't stand up in front of people, and I'm too close. You know, I don't want to cry in front of everybody or make them uncomfortable. I can't do that. Besides, I was, probably 39 years old at the time, and I don't know. I don't know how old I am now. I'm 68 now, so do the math. I'm 79. I don't know how old I was then. But I was much younger. She said, why don't you write the eulogy, and we'll give it to the minister to read, and then acknowledge that it was from you. So I thought, well, I guess I could do that. But I had never gone to a church before to hear eulogies given by other people. I didn't know what they were like. I certainly never wrote a eulogy before, so I was given this huge job to do, and I said, okay, I'll do it, you know, not knowing how to do it. I couldn't write. I just couldn't write this eulogy. I didn't know how to. So one night, actually the night before his funeral, I decided to get in my car and just go someplace to just get out of the house, and maybe I'll be able to write something somewhere else. So aimlessly I'm driving down through the country roads where I live, and of course I'm crying, you know, how could he die at 39 years of age, and we're supposed to grow old together, you know, and we're supposed to go on camping trips and climb mountains together, this isn't fair, boo, 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 boo. And I saw a forest, and I was drawn to the forest. Now, I'm going entirely on intuition. I don't know why I pulled my car over, stopped, got out of the car, took my pencil and notepad with me and walked into the woods. I don't know why, except that something was guiding me there. I saw a beautiful stream and a big boulder, and I sat on the boulder, and as soon as I did that, I sensed my friend John's presence with me. I mean, it was as if he was right there with me. I felt this tremendous peace. I'm analytical, right? So I'm thinking, this can't be. I know John's dead. I'm having wishful thinking thoughts or whatever, you know. No, he's not here. Yes, he was here. I said, well, I guess I'll try to write this eulogy. So as soon as my pen hit my notepad, it started going like this, really, really fast. I didn't know at that time what automatic writing was, never heard of it before. I was not into that stuff. It's just going, next page. All the while I'm thinking, analytical again, what in the heck, what am I doing? My hand is going so fast. What's going on? Nancy, you are really cracking up. Trying to convince myself, you know, that something's wrong here, you know. I'm not thinking of any words on there. My pen stopped at the end, and then I put the pages over and started looking at, oh, here's some word. Goodness, there's a sentence. Oh, my goodness. And this is the eulogy. How could I have written a eulogy when I wasn't even thinking of those things? And there was one part in the eulogy that was written in a totally different style of writing, unfamiliar to me. I'm going to skip forward just for a sec. His wife, after I delivered the eulogy, came up to me and said, how did you know that was John's favorite passage from Cahil Gibran's The Prophet? At that time in my life, I never heard of Cahil Gibran. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I didn't know if that was the name of a person or a book or a movie or a guy. I had no idea. So she told me. Of course, I didn't tell her how it came about. I just kind of ripped it off. But I'd like to read that part for you. It's also in my book. Much have we loved you, but speechless was our love, and with veils has it been veiled. Yet now it cries aloud unto you, and would stand revealed before you. And ever has it been that love knows not its own depth until the hour of separation. Now where did that come from? I knew at that minute that something of a supernatural thing happened while I was seated on that rock and sensed my friend's presence with me. Okay, so I wasn't going to deliver the eulogy, right? We were just going to hand it over to the minister to read. So all I did was go home and type it up. I didn't need to practice it or become familiar with it. Just give it to the minister the next morning. I went to the funeral home with my family, and his wife came up to me. Oh, getting ahead of myself. Went to the funeral home. About 15 minutes before the service, I felt this tremendous energy surge starting from my tips of my toes and going up my whole body very rhythmically, up the back of my spine, and exited out the top of my head. When that happened, I felt such tremendous freedom, if you will, like my shoulders had helium balloons attached to them. I no longer had to grieve for my friend. I knew somehow that he was okay, that he was happy. And then his wife came to me and said, you have the eulogy. I'll give it to the minister. And I don't know why these words came out of my mouth. They just popped out. They said, no, I have to be the one to deliver the eulogy.
Where'd that come from?
Are you sure? Yes, I'm absolutely. We went over this. You said you'd be upset. No, I'm fine. I'm fine. Just let me deliver the eulogy. All right. So I heard my name being called forth, and I was coming from this side of the room, and I was just going to go to the podium and read the eulogy. I'm walking over here, and all of a sudden I feel my right hand grasped in my deceased friend's hand. It was so strong, I even stopped and looked as if to acknowledge him. I didn't see with my physical eyes. I saw with some other enhanced sense. I can't explain it to you unless you've experienced it yourself somehow. Well, my analytical thing is coming back again. Nancy, you know he's lying in the coffin. You know he's dead. Come on, Nancy. Pretty soon you're going to be right at that podium. You have to give that eulogy. Convince yourself later that you're cracking up. I did. So there I am at the podium, and I'm now going to deliver the eulogy. I read about 3 sentences into the eulogy. I am told by my deceased friend's wife that from that point on, my eyes never went back down to the paper again. I didn't practice it. I didn't. Even now, I have to. As many talks as I've given, I still can't say it verbatim. I have to read it, you know. Where did I get that from? I'm standing there. As my eyes lifted, I saw this brilliant white light appearing in the back of the room to the left, coming toward me. It was the most incredible outpouring of unconditional love. I have never in my life experienced anything like this before. The light was coming toward me. I just wish I could unzip myself and show you this love. And there are no words. There are no human words. Language is so inferior to describe this love. For me, someone who couldn't believe that God could love her, someone who self-esteem was zero, minus zero, minus, minus zero, for many, many years of her life. And suddenly I felt this tremendous love. I felt that I was in a state of grace, that I was pure, that I was perfect. You know me, I'm not perfect. I know I'm not perfect. But yet the light saw me as perfect, and I was perfect. I lifted out of my body, emerged into oneness, total oneness with the light. Every cell in my body responded to seeing the light. It was as if every cell recognized who the light was. I say who because the light was not light like we have on this planet Earth like this. The light was a being of unconditional love. The light was the light of God, and I was in that presence. My whole body felt like I was having a nuclear explosion of unconditional love just being poured into me. So much love. I felt that I was home. It was the same light that I had seen during my first NDE, although at that time I hadn't merged into oneness with the light then, as I am at this point in 1979. I felt I was home, where I truly belonged, where I came from, and where I ultimately belong and will go to again at the end of my life. When I lifted out of my body, I saw Nancy delivering the eulogy. So another aspect of self had lifted out of that physical body. So it was not brain, you know, or mind. It was my interpretation, spirit or soul, or higher self, if you want. I also want to ask your respect when I call this light the light of God. But that is my interpretation. I didn't have to think about it, analyze it. I knew it was God. How can I describe this? It would be as if you knew a family member who walked right in right now. You would recognize it and know who that was. And that's similarly how I knew I was in the presence of the light of God. We lifted out of the funeral home, above the city, above the state, above the planet, if you will, into a dark universe. I was able to see the planets and the stars and everything. Well, we had stopped after a while, and I was being shown, this is the hard part, about 11 or so or more dimensions. I don't know how to describe this because I don't have the language for this. As an after effect of this experience, I became very interested in cosmology and quantum mechanics, you know. But this is, again, typical of the NDEers. You know, they come back and they go in different directions, and knowledge is very important to them. They want to learn, they want to find out. So part of me is trying to understand, on a quantum level, these different 11 dimensions that I experienced. And so I've always said, I've got to get my head together with a good quantum physicist who won't talk above my head, you know, but try to help me get the words out. I have the pictures in my head, but I don't have the words or the language, so I just have to ask your forgiveness, and I can't comment on that aspect of the experience. The light and I travel back to the beginning of creation. We stopped and I was shown that everything, matter, atoms, molecules, everything has at its core a spark of light. The same light that I was during my experience. The light of God, the creator, if you will. Again, if the word God offends anyone, please substitute your own meaning for the highest of the high, whatever that might be for you. Language gets in the way when we're talking about something so profound like this. So whatever is meaningful to you, please use that word. The light of God began teaching me about man's true nature, that we are all aspects of the divine, that we have the divine presence or the light inside of us. But what we've done through our lives is we've covered that precious light up like an onion skin. I was shown an onion skin, how layer upon layer we surround ourselves, we cover ourselves up with false perceptions about who we are. We take on negative thoughts about ourselves, our self-image. We get entangled in a lot of guilt trips that we should forgive ourselves for and move on past that, you know, but no, we like this super glue that we have, you know, around us, you know, it gives us comfort to know that we're, you know, but the light was showing me we need to undo all of that so we can get down to our true self and live outwardly from that true part of ourselves, which is the light. I was shown how the smallest acts of kindness are huge acts, spiritually speaking. Why? Because the ego isn't involved. I was taught by my great teacher, if you will, all about ego. The random small acts that we do for someone, we're not expecting a pat on the back. We don't, you know, we just do it because it's the loving thing to do. We're responding from our core being, which is the light inside of us, which is love. And that's what is so amazing. I mean, it blew me away. It was such a light bulb moment. You mean that little thing is spiritually significant? You know? Yeah. Wow, was that big. I also was shown how the opposite of that, like small acts of deception or lies or whatever, trickery, those little tiny little things are actually big things spiritually not to do. Why? Because you're acting from your ego again. You want to either feel superior to someone else, so you put someone else down, or you might tell a white lie for whatever reason. It's all feeding into ego. Ego is not of a spiritual self because it's usually not a loving act. I do want to say that ego does play a very important role in our lives. Okay, so I'm not saying get rid of ego. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying it has its place. We make great strides in theater and arts and science, etc., by using our ego, you know. We make good gains in those things. But if we're going to be doing anything spiritually to enhance our spiritual self and get back down to our true nature from whence we are supposed to live, then ego, you know, needs to be transcended in those conditions. The message from the light is love, only love. I was shown that immensely. All communication that took place was telepathic. If I had a question, the answer was telepathically placed in my mind the moment I thought of something. There was no time. Everything was happening simultaneously at the same time. It's taken time for me to describe everything that happened to me, but at that time in the experience, there was no time. So everything happened at the same moment, if you will. Not this happened first, this happened second, this happened third. And that's hard to understand, but yet I experienced that. Another thing that I experienced when I lifted out of my body, the very first thing that I saw was the realization that, oh my goodness, the earth plane, that what I had just left is all an illusion. That was a shocker to me. I know there's probably going to be questions about that. What do you mean by illusion? This is reality, you know. Just want to share, please bear with me, share what happened. I have questions too, just like you do, I'm sure. But it was all an illusion. And I also thought of my scientific colleague who were working all of their lives to disprove the obvious. And I thought, oh, I feel so sorry for them when they cross over at the end of their lives and discover, oh, we do live on. Oh, my goodness. What was I doing? And I had great compassion for them. I think I put something in my mind at that time that I was, if I was going to come back, I hadn't thought about coming back yet, but somehow the notion was that I was going to help my scientific colleagues in some way to learn more about other dimensions that I had just entered into. I had a life review. And this life review was very, very painful for me because the message of my life and of humankind's lives is the question, how much did you love while you were here on Earth? And so I was shown all those times when I didn't love self, when I was critical of others, critical of myself, that's an unloving thing to do, when I was vindictive, I mean, if you did something to me, well, I'll get you back somehow. You know, I really wasn't such a bad person, but knowing what I know, you know, and looking back, those little small things are huge, you know, to me. Once you see the reality and see the truth and are with the light. But all the while, the light was loving me unconditionally through that life review. I don't know how else to put it except that I just felt great remorse in not having known about this ahead of time. You know, like maybe I would have done things differently if I had known that I was going to... I had always grown up with the idea that when you die, there's a punishing God, and he keeps track, you know, on a tablet, you know, good, bad deed, or whatever, and tallies them up, and then that determines if you're going up there or going down there. That was my belief at that time, but this is not what I experienced. I experienced this unconditional love, almost as a mother or a father embracing their child, loving them through a very difficult and painful situation with complete understanding and knowing what we were experiencing, all for the purpose of learning how to do better or what the meaning of life is. I wanted to stay with the light. I want it in the worst way. In fact, I remember thinking, oh, well, Nancy's, you know, Nancy's delivering the eulogy. I have to be separated from that physical body if I want to stay here with the light of God. And so I remember thinking mentally, well, I could give her a heart attack, you know. And then I was cut off real short. The light said, no, you cannot stay. I have work for you to do. You are to return. You are to become a communicator, to help people understand there is life after death, to become aware of their true nature, and to help them to learn to live their lives expressing unconditional love for one another. Oh, yes, yes, I want to do this because, not to elevate myself, you know, oh, wow, I'm going to become a communicator. No. It was, I can be a messenger. I could be of service to the light and to my fellow human beings. I can share with them the good news that I was receiving from the light of God during that experience. I can help people in some way. And so I said, yes. And then, again, I'm paraphrasing. He said, whoa, slow down. But before you make your decision, you have to know what you're getting into. And so I'm going to show you both the negative and the positive aspects of the work that I'm calling you to do. And first, I saw the negative aspects. I saw all my friends exit my life. They thought I was crazy. Every single friend I had was gone. I saw my own family think I was crazy. Or that can't happen, you know. I mean, you must have had a hallucination. No, you haven't had a hallucination. This was real. Yeah. So my own family is not supportive of this. I saw myself standing before audiences like this, sharing this experience and the message of the light. And I saw people looking at each other. I saw people walking out of my talks. I just saw people thinking, this is ridiculous, you know. Let's get out of here, you know. I just saw them just turning away. And that hurt me deeply, not the ego I. While I was in this experience, there was no ego I present. I was one with the light of God, merged into total oneness. So I felt pain for the light. It wasn't me that I want recognition. I want the recognition be for the light. Let the light's message come forth. And if I'm being called to do this in some way, just let me be the microphone. Don't let me be the message. And so I felt, if they only knew, those people walking away and turning their backs and snickering, if they only knew how much the light loves them, each one, no matter who you are. And one of the greatest gifts that I received when I received that love was that the love was not for me. I experienced it for you and you and you. I experienced it for everyone. That was tremendous. It allowed me to know with certainty that I am loved no more than a Mother Teresa, no less than a Mother Teresa. All loved equally. There is no distinction between the children of the universe. All are equal in the light's love. Equal, unconditionally, meaning no matter what you do, still going to be loved as much. There will be no lessening of that love. We love conditionally. So that's why it's so difficult for us to know or understand what unconditional love is. We just don't know it. And I'm at a loss for words to try to describe that kind of love. Those of you who are NDEers know what I'm talking about, and you've been called, just as I have, to bring that message forward to humanity, share that message, be an example to others through your own lives, show the light, spread it. I also saw the positive aspects of my work. I saw myself standing before audiences like this, and I saw people listening warmly and intently. I saw these little red hearts just going up from them and floating up toward the light, you know, signifying a raise in consciousness, if you will, you know, higher consciousness, moving from a level that perhaps they were to just a little bit higher, If only for 5 minutes, I was still serving in the manner that I'm being called to do, no matter what those negative scenes looked like. I also saw myself working on a one-to-one basis with people. I saw myself just communicating any way that I can, sharing that good news. And I said, yes, I will come back. I will accept this work. Once I did that, tremendous knowledge entered into my consciousness. It was as if volumes and volumes and volumes just went boom, 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 as if all the written words, past, present, and future, all the spoken words, past, present, and future, were all recorded somehow and just given to me. Boom! I understood everything. I also received another message. With the gift you have now received, go forth and tell the masses that life after death exists, that you shall all experience my profound love. Love is the key to the universe. You must all learn to live in peace and harmony with one another on earth while you have the chance. This will be a difficult task for you, my child, but you shall do it. As long as you hold on to my hand and don't let go, I shall lead, you shall follow. The path ahead of you shall be prepared for you. Then I had a scene appear before me in which I saw a long wooden table and 12 individuals seated around the table. I was standing at the head of the table. We all had on what appeared to be monk's garb, you know, the brown belt, you know, long robe-like, and sandals we wore. All but three of the individuals had their hoods covering their faces, and the three to my right had their hoods off so I could see who they were. In my experience, I didn't know who they were. I never met these people before. But guess what? When I came back here several years later, I met the first individual. A couple years later, I met the second. I met the third one. The purpose of that meeting during my experience with all 12 individuals was that they were promising to help me with my mission when I came back to this earth plane, that they would come into my life at the appropriate time to help me. And I swear to you, I never knew these three people on earth until they popped into my life. And you would be surprised to learn who some of them are. But and I won't reveal that. In fact, I never revealed it to the three individuals. Why? I didn't want their ego self to think, oh, wow, I better help her because that's what I'm supposed to do. No, no, no. Their soul, their spirit, knows what they're supposed to do. And so I just never did anything. And they came and they helped me without my asking, without any coercion. They just said, here, suppose I do this. Suppose I give you this. Suppose I do this. Help you with that. They have been an immense help to me. Just recently, I told the first one about it. And he said, you know what? I've always wondered why you, of all people, of all the thousands of NDEers and people that I've come in contact with, why you have been so special. You know, he said, now it all makes sense. He said, because right from the get-go, I wanted to help you. Same thing for the other two. And it's just amazing. I felt I better tell them because they're nearing the end of their life, and I just wanted them to, you know, they've already helped me, and it'd be kind of nice for them to know that they came back to help me, and we both did something great. As the light and I were returning back to the earth plane, we stopped, and I was able to see the planet, and I saw a lot of the destruction, the wars, the derelicts in the street, just awful chaos and everything. But I understood, and this won't make sense to you, I know, I understood that everything was working out the way it's supposed to work out. Yes, even the chaos, I understood it, and it was no big thing for me at that time to witness all of this cruelty and yet know that it served a purpose in some way. Now, coming back here in the Earth plane, I have the same questions you do. One of the first questions I'm going to ask when I get back up there, I forgot, what I remember. Could you brush, my memory again that it made sense? But I do at the same time know that it does make sense, so I don't have to experience a lot of frustration and pain when I see things. I've just been able to see, well, I don't understand it, but I know the light was showing me that somehow it did make sense. And so I trust the light. I trust it. Then there was a final hug from the light as the light was fading away into the distance. Nancy was finishing up her eulogy. Fading into the distance. I can't tell you the agony I felt. Oh, I want to go with the light. I want to be with the light, but I promised I'd be here, and I knew that one day I would reunite with the light again and it would be okay. But it was very, very painful for me to see the light going away. And one final word was spoken, and that was book. And placed within my entire being was the knowledge that I would write a book and share with people what happened and more about the message of the light as it would pertain to human beings. And I promised I would do that. And then the experience ended. And I was back at the podium finishing up the last two or three sentences of the eulogy. So from that moment on, I was totally transformed. I was looking at everyone in the chapel with so much love for everyone, even though I didn't even know half the people. They were total strangers. I felt so much love. Oh, my gosh. And then we were leaving to go to the mother's house for refreshments afterwards. I got in the car, and I told my husband, I said, John was with me when I was delivering the eulogy, and God was with me too. And he looked at me, and I looked at my two sons in the back seat, and they looked at me scared. And I decided right then and there, never bring this subject up again. From that moment on, I was transformed. The after effects of this experience are also identical, similar to those experienced by near-death experiencers. I'll just go over a few of them. When I promised my mission to fulfill for the light of God, about writing that book, I had a lot of trouble writing the book. I'd never written anything before in my life, only some letters to my parents. And I didn't know how to write. So every time I'd go to write something, nothing was coming through. I was getting really, really frustrated because after all, I promised God, right? You mean you don't back out of a promise, like that. And I couldn't do it. And so a number of years went by, and I finally, in my mind, came to the conclusion, the awful conclusion, I can't do this. I failed God. I just can't do it. I was devastated, thinking that my promise was just not going to happen. And so I remember praying deeply and earnestly and spilling out all my guts and saying, I can't do this. I can't write. I said, you made a promise to me, too, that as long as I held on your hand and don't let go, you would help me. So I'm going to trust you with everything that I have for you to step up to the plate, because I'm willing to step up to the plate. And if you can help me write, I sure would appreciate it. It was a little more, dramatic than that, I can assure you. I was sobbing and pouring my heart out, asking for help. And when I did that, I got my ego out of the way. What did I want the reader to know in the book? How did I want to present the chapters? When I got out of the way and said, okay, use me, here I am. I don't know what you want to write, but I'm available. When I did that, honestly and sincerely, then the writing came. I would wake up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning with all these words and thoughts and sentences, and I'd run to the computer and write them down. And that's how the book came about, honestly. So I'm here to tell you that I'm not the true author. Hear his voice, the true story of modern-day mystical encounter with God. It came from a higher source, and I leave that to your own discretion as to who or what that higher source is. But I believe that it's divinely inspired through me, that it came through. When I read the book myself, it's like I'm reading someone else's book, because I don't recognize the writing. I don't write that way. People who know me will back that up. After that book was published, I figured I was off the hook now. After all, I had finished, I fulfilled my promise, right? I didn't have to write anymore. I did it. Now I could sit back and, you know, just give talks or help people one-to-one. I'll tell you how My Beloved, the second book, came about. Because again, I'm not the author. My husband has end-stage renal failure. He's on kidney dialysis. He gets seizures every day. He's diabetic. He has heart problems. And I take him to kidney dialysis 3 times a week. And I sit in the waiting room for 5 hours at a time, you know, waiting for him to be off the machine. And after a year of doing this, just thinking, you know, this is boring, sitting here, you know, 5 hours, butt's getting sore, you know, and things, and I just can't take this anymore. And it's a far drive from home, so it's not like I can just drive home again and I come back when he's finished with the treatment. I said, well, maybe I'll go shopping or something, find something around the dialysis center. And I found a library. So I thought, oh, well, this is nice. It's a nice, quiet, soundproof room. I'll go there and sit at a desk. And I don't know what I'll do. I just started thinking about God, started thinking about my experience and how blessed I am and loving God the way I do. It's just all this love was just pouring out to, you know, in my thoughts, you know, communing with Spirit that way, the divine presence within me. And I started hearing back these lovely words or sentences. And I went, oh, that was beautiful. Where did that come from, you know? Oh, that was nice. And I'd let it go. And then I'd talk some more, you know, in my mind. And all of a sudden, these words would come in. And I would do that for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, I guess, I was doing that. And I was thinking about it one day, and I said, boy, those words are really nice, and I can't remember them once they ended, you know. You know, I ought to just write them down when they come through like that, so I can remember them. That's all I was going to do, just so I could remember them. So that's what I started doing. And in the course of a year, I was looking through my notebook at all these things, and I'm, wow, man, that is so nice. That's so true. And I thought, is this another book? No. I said, no, I don't want to write another book. And so I took it to prayer. And I asked whether or not that it was, and I had guidance that it was. So that's how this book came about. Let me just share with you some of those really neat things. In the book, there are just sentences that just came to me. And each one starts with, my beloved. Love is not something that you have. Love is something that has you. My beloved, you are an earthen vessel filled with my divine love to pour out to others. You don't have to be a perfect vessel, but only to remain available for divine purpose. I will use you, cracks and all. My beloved, to do what you love is to honor the one who ignited the passion within you to love what you do. My beloved, I will meet you where you are, not where you think you should be. Oh, I love that. Because we always want, you know, think that, well, we won't get favor unless we're perfect or, you know, God's love is not like that. My beloved, I do not value the size of your gifts you give to others as much as I value the size of your heart in your giving. Beloved, be patient with me. Realize there are processes involved before your answers come. And the last one I'll share with you. My beloved, when at last your earthly life is through, my grace will bring you home to be with me. You will no longer believe in me. You will know me. 70-minute CD, I talk about God is closer than we think. how we can look at the ordinary moments of our lives and realize that there is a divine presence working in and through us to help others and others to help us in some way. The only other after effects that I briefly want to share, I know my time is probably getting near to conclude, I don't have any interest in materialism, and I know a lot of NDEers feel the same way too, but here's a little proof that I want to offer. 10 years after my experience in 1989, our home burnt down. We lost all of our material possessions. And I moved through that like a leaf floating down the stream. I wasn't anxious about what we lost. My husband and son were, they were bananas, but I was okay with it. We can replace stuff, you know, it's just stuff. I went to garage sales afterwards and got a house full of gently used, beautiful things that are functional for us. I have a greater capacity to love others and forgive self and others. Probably the most pronounced after effect is that my whole life is centered upon the light. I eat, breathe, drink. I cannot get enough of the light's presence with me. I want more, I want more, I want more. It's like I'm insatiable, I thirst for it. It's my breath, it's my life. It's the center of my life, it's the periphery of my life, it's the all of my life. And I spend a lot of time just in one-to-one communion daily with the light. I feel that the light never left me. That's the truth. I feel that presence with me always. I have an extremely close bond with nature. I can go out into the woods where I live and wild animals will come up to me and sit with me. I have a story in the book about a young fawn who came up and I don't want to tell you that story. But and raccoons will just come up to me and climb on my shoulders and just perch there. And we're loving it. You see, I think animals sense the divine presence, the divine love, the divine light in us. And when we are open, when we get rid of a lot of that onion skin covering, more of it can show. And as a result, we draw so much to us in the form of life experiences that bless us and heal us. And life is a joy. I have an inner peace always, an inner joy always.
Let's give her a warm hand. We want to say some questions.